acute dismay of the members of such groups, the end has never appeared as scheduled. But immediately following the obvious failure of the prophecy, history records an enigmatic pattern. Rather than disbanding in disillusion, the cultists often become strengthened in their convictions. Risking the ridicule of the populace, they take to the streets, publicly asserting their dogma and seeking converts with a fervor that is intensified, not diminished, by the clear disconfirmation of a central belief. So it was with the Montanists of 2nd century Turkey, with the Anabaptists of 16th century Holland, with the Sabbateists of 17th century Izmir, with the Millerites of 19th century America. And, thought a trio of interested social scientists, so it might be with a doomsday cult based in modern-day Chicago. The scientists, Leon Festinger, Henry Reakin, and Stanley Schachter, who were then colleagues at the University of Minnesota, heard about the Chicago group and felt it worthy of close study. Their decision to investigate by joining the group incognito as new believers, and by placing additional paid observers among its ranks, resulted in a remarkably rich first-hand account of the goings-on before and after the day of predicted catastrophe. The cult of believers was small, never numbering more than 30 members. Its leaders were a middle-aged man and woman, whom the researchers renamed, for purposes of publication, Dr. Thomas Armstrong and Mrs. Marion Keach. Dr. Armstrong, a physician on the staff of a college student health service, had a long-held interest in mysticism, the occult, and flying saucers. As such, he served as a respected authority on these subjects for the group. Mrs. Keach, though, was the center of attention and activity. Earlier in the year, she had begun to receive messages from spiritual beings, whom she called the Guardians, located on other planets. It was these messages flowing through Marion Keach's hand via the device of automatic writing that were to form the bulk of the cult's religious belief system. The teachings of the Guardians were loosely linked to traditional Christian thought. No wonder that one of the Guardians, Sananda, eventually revealed himself as the current embodiment of Jesus. The transmissions from the Guardians, always the subjects of much discussion and interpretation among the group, gained new significance when they began to foretell a great impending disaster, a flood that would begin in the Western Hemisphere and eventually engulf the world. Although the cultists were understandably alarmed at first, further messages assured them that they and all those who believed in the lessons sent through Mrs. Keach would survive. Before the calamity, spacemen were to arrive and carry off the believers in flying saucers to a place of safety, presumably on another planet. Very little detail was provided about the rescue, except that the believers were to make themselves ready for pickup by rehearsing certain passwords to be exchanged. I left my hat at home. What is your question? I am my own porter. And by removing all metal from their clothes, because the wearing or carrying of metal made saucer travel extremely dangerous. As Festinger, Reakin, and Schachter observed the preparations during the weeks prior to the flood date, they noted with special interest two significant aspects of the members' behavior. First, the level of commitment to the cult's belief system was very high. In anticipation of their departure from doomed Earth, irrevocable steps were taken by the group members. Most had incurred the opposition of family and friends to their beliefs, but had persisted nonetheless in their convictions, often when it meant losing the affections of these others. In fact, several of the members were threatened by neighbors or family with legal actions designed to have them declared insane. In Dr. Armstrong's case, a motion was filed by his sister to have his two younger children taken away. Many believers quit their jobs or neglected their studies to devote full time to the movement. Some even gave or threw away their personal belongings, expecting them shortly to be of no use. These were people whose certainty that they had the truth allowed them to withstand enormous social, economic, and legal pressures, and whose commitment to their dogma grew as each pressure was resisted. The second significant aspect of the believers' pre-flood actions was a curious form of inaction, For individuals so clearly convinced of the validity of their creed, they did surprisingly little to spread the word, although they did initially make public the news of the coming disaster. There was no attempt to seek converts, to proselyte actively. They were willing to sound the alarm and to counsel those who voluntarily responded to it, but that was all. The group's distaste for recruitment efforts was evident in various ways, besides the lack of personal persuasion attempts. Secrecy was maintained in many matters. Extra copies of the lessons were burned. Passwords and secret signs were instituted. The contents of certain private tape recordings were not to be discussed with outsiders. So secret were the tapes that even long-time believers were prohibited from taking notes of them. Publicity was avoided. As the day of disaster approached, increasing numbers of newspaper, television, and radio reporters converged on the group's headquarters in the Keach House. For the most part, those people were turned away or ignored. The most frequent answer to their questions was no comment. Although discouraged for a time, the media representatives returned with a vengeance when Dr. Armstrong's religious activities caused him to be fired from his post on the College Health Service staff. One especially persistent newsman had to be threatened with a lawsuit. A similar siege was repelled on the eve of the flood when a swarm of reporters pushed and pestered the believers for information. Afterward, the researchers summarized the group's pre-flood stance on public exposure and recruitment in respectful tones. Exposed to a tremendous burst of publicity, they had made every attempt to dodge fame. Given dozens of opportunities to proselyte, they had remained evasive and secretive and behaved with an almost superior indifference. Eventually, when all the reporters and would-be converts had been cleared from the house, the believers began making their final preparations for the arrival of the spaceship scheduled for midnight that night. The scene, as viewed by Festinger, Rieken, and Schachter, must have seemed like absurdist theater. Otherwise ordinary people, housewives, college students, a high school boy, a publisher, an MD, a hardware store clerk and his mother, were participating earnestly in tragic comedy. They took direction from a pair of members who were periodically in touch with the Guardians. Marion Keach's written messages from Sananda were being supplemented that evening by the Bertha, a former beautician through whose tongue the Creator gave instruction. They rehearsed their lines diligently, calling out in chorus the responses to be made before entering the rescue saucer. I am my own porter. I am my own pointer. They discussed seriously whether the message from a caller identifying himself as Captain Video, a TV space character of the time, was properly interpreted as a prank or a coded communication from their rescuers. And they performed in costume. In keeping with the admonition to carry nothing metallic aboard the saucer, the believers wore clothing that had been cut open to allow the metal pieces to be torn out. The metal eyelets in their shoes had been ripped away. The women were braless or wore brassieres whose metal stays had been removed. The men had yanked the zippers out of their pants, which were supported by lengths of rope in place of belts. The group's fanaticism concerning the removal of all metal was vividly experienced by one of the researchers, who remarked, 25 minutes before midnight, that he had forgotten to extract the zipper from his trousers. As the observers tell it, this knowledge produced a near-panic reaction. He was rushed into the bedroom, where Dr. Armstrong, his hands trembling and his eyes darting to the clock every few seconds, slashed out the zipper with a razor blade and wrenched its clasps free with wire cutters. The hurried operation finished, the researcher was returned to the living room, a slightly less metallic but, one supposes, much paler man. As the time appointed for their departure grew very close, the believers settled into a lull of soundless anticipation. With trained scientists on site, we are afforded a detailed account of the events that transpired during this momentous period in the life of the group. The last 10 minutes were tense ones for the group in the living room. They had nothing to do but sit and wait, their coats in their laps. In the tense silence, 2 clocks ticked loudly, one about 10 minutes faster than the other. When the faster of the two pointed to 12:05, one of the observers remarked aloud on the fact. A chorus of people replied that midnight had not yet come. Bob Eastman affirmed that the slower clock was correct. He had set it himself only that afternoon. It showed only 4 minutes before midnight. These 4 minutes passed in complete silence, except for a single utterance. When the slower clock on the mantel showed only 1 minute remaining before the guide to the saucer was due, Marion exclaimed in a strained, high-pitched voice, "And not a plan has gone astray." The clock chimed 12, each stroke painfully clear in the expectant hush. The believers sat motionless. One might have expected some visible reaction. Midnight had passed, and nothing had happened. The cataclysm itself was less than 7 hours away, but there was little to see in the reactions of the people in that room. There was no talking, no sound. People sat stock still, their faces seemingly frozen and expressionless. Mark Post was the only person who even moved. He lay down on the sofa and closed his eyes, but did not sleep. Later, when spoken to, he answered monosyllabically, but otherwise lay immobile. The others showed nothing on the surface, although it became clear later that they had been hit hard. Gradually, painfully, an atmosphere of despair and confusion settled over the group. They re-examined the prediction and the accompanying messages. Dr. Armstrong and Mrs. Keach reiterated their faith. The believers mulled over their predicament and discarded explanation after explanation as unsatisfactory. At one point, toward 4 a.m., Mrs. Keach broke down and cried bitterly. She knew, she sobbed, that there were some who were beginning to doubt, but that the group must beam light to those who needed it most, and that the group must hold together. The rest of the believers were losing their composure, too. They were all visibly shaken, and many were close to tears. It was now almost 4:30 a.m., and still no way of handling the disconfirmation had been found. By now, too, most of the group were talking openly about the failure of the escort to come at midnight. The group seemed near dissolution. In the midst of this gathering doubt, as cracks crawled through the believers' confidence, the researchers witnessed a pair of remarkable incidents, one after another. The first occurred at about 4:45 a.m. when Marion Keach's hand suddenly leapt to the task of transcribing through automatic writing the text of a holy message from above. When read aloud, the communication proved to be an elegant explanation for the events of that night. The little group, sitting alone all night long, had spread so much light that God had saved the world from destruction. Although neat and efficient, this explanation was not wholly satisfying by itself. For example, after hearing it, one member simply rose, put on his hat and coat, and left. Something additional was needed to restore the believers to their previous levels of faith. It was at this point that the second notable incident occurred to meet that need. Once again, the words of those who were present offer a vivid description. The atmosphere in the group changed abruptly, and so did their behavior. Within minutes after she had read the message explaining the disconfirmation, Mrs. Keach received another message instructing her to publicize the explanation. She reached for the telephone and began dialing the number of a newspaper. While she was waiting to be connected, someone asked, "Marion, is this the first time you have called the newspaper yourself?" Her reply was immediate. "Oh, yes, this is the first time I have ever called them. I have never had anything to tell them before, but now I feel it is urgent." The whole group could have echoed her feelings, for they all felt a sense of urgency. As soon as Marion had finished her call, the other members took turns, telephoning newspapers, wire services, radio stations, and national magazines to spread the explanation of the failure of the flood. In their desire to spread the word quickly and resoundingly, the believers now opened for public attention matters that had been thus far utterly secret. Where only hours earlier they had shunned newspaper reporters and felt that the attention they were getting in the press was painful, they now became avid seekers for publicity. Not only had the long-standing policies concerning secrecy and publicity done an about-face, so too had the group's attitude toward potential converts. Whereas likely recruits who previously visited the house had been mostly ignored, turned away, or treated with casual attention. The day following the disconfirmation saw a different story. All callers were admitted, all questions were answered, attempts were made to proselyte all such visitors. The members' unprecedented willingness to accommodate possible new recruits was perhaps best demonstrated when 9 high school students arrived on the following night to speak with Mrs. Keach. They found her at the telephone, deep in a discussion of flying saucers with a caller whom, it later turned out, she believed to be a spaceman. Eager to continue talking to him, and at the same time anxious to keep her new guests, Marion simply included them in the conversation and, for more than an hour, chatted alternately with her guests in the living room and the spaceman on the other end of the telephone. So intent was she on proselyting that she seemed unable to let any opportunity go by. To what can we attribute the believers' radical turnabout? In the space of a few hours, they went from clannish and taciturn hoarders of the word to expansive and eager disseminators of it. And what could have possessed them to choose such an ill-timed instant, when the failure of the flood was likely to cause non-believers to view the group and its dogma as laughable? The crucial event occurred sometime during the night of the flood, when it became increasingly clear that the prophecy would not be fulfilled. Oddly, it was not their prior certainty that drove the members to propagate the faith. It was an encroaching sense of uncertainty. It was the dawning realization that if the spaceship and flood predictions were wrong, so might be the entire belief system on which they rested. For those huddled in the Keach living room, that growing possibility must have seemed hideous. The group members had gone too far, given up too much for their beliefs to see them destroyed. The shame, the economic cost, the mockery would be too great to bear. The overarching need of the cultists to cling to those beliefs seeps poignantly from their own words, from a young woman with a 3-year-old child. I have to believe the flood is coming on the 21st because I've spent all my money. I quit my job, I quit computer school. I have to believe. And from Dr. Armstrong to one of the researchers 4 hours after the failure of the saucermen to arrive, I've had to go a long way. I've given up just about everything. I've cut every tie. I've burned every bridge. I've turned my back on the world. I can't afford to doubt. I have to believe, and there isn't any other truth. Imagine the corner in which Dr. Armstrong and his followers found themselves as morning approached. So massive was the commitment to their beliefs that no other truth was tolerable. Yet that set of beliefs had just taken a merciless pounding from physical reality. No saucer had landed. No spaceman had knocked. No flood had come. Nothing had happened as prophesied. Since the only acceptable form of truth had been undercut by physical proof, there was but one way out of the corner for the group. They had to establish another type of proof for the validity of their beliefs. Social proof. This then explains their sudden shift from secretive conspirators to zealous missionaries, and it explains the curious timing of the shift, precisely when a direct disconfirmation of their beliefs had rendered them least convincing to outsiders. It was necessary to risk the scorn and derision of the non-believers because publicity and recruitment efforts provided the only remaining hope. If they could spread the word, if they could inform the uninformed, if they could persuade the skeptics, and if by so doing they could win new converts, their threatened but treasured beliefs would become truer. The principle of social proof says so. The greater the number of people who find any idea correct, the more the idea will be correct. The group's assignment was clear. Since the physical evidence could not be changed, the social evidence had to be. Convince, and ye shall be convinced. Cause of death, uncertainty. All the weapons of influence discussed in this book work better under some conditions than under others. If we are to defend ourselves adequately against any such weapon, it is vital that we know its optimal operating conditions in order to recognize when we are most vulnerable to its influence. In the case of the principle of social proof, we have already had a hint of one time when it works best. Among the Chicago believers, it was a sense of shaken confidence that triggered their craving for converts. In general, when we are unsure of ourselves, when the situation is unclear or ambiguous, when uncertainty reigns, we are most likely to look to and accept the actions of others as correct. In the process of examining the reactions of other people to resolve our uncertainty, however, we are likely to overlook a subtle but important fact. Those people are probably examining the social evidence, too. Especially in an ambiguous situation, the tendency for everyone to be looking to see what everyone else is doing can lead to a fascinating phenomenon called pluralistic ignorance. A thorough understanding of the pluralistic ignorance phenomenon helps immeasurably to explain a regular occurrence in our country that has been termed both a riddle and a national disgrace. The failure of entire groups of bystanders to aid victims in agonizing need of help. The classic example of such bystander inaction, and the one that has produced the most debate in journalistic, political, and scientific circles, began as an ordinary homicide case in the borough of Queens in New York City. A woman in her late 20s, Catherine Genovese, was killed in a late-night attack on her home street as she returned from work. Murder is never an act to be passed off lightly. But in a city the size and tenor of New York, the Genovese incident warranted no more space than a fraction of a column in the New York Times. Catherine Genovese's story would have died with her on that day in March 1964, if it hadn't been for a mistake. The Metropolitan Editor of the Times, A.M. Rosenthal, happened to be having lunch with the city police commissioner a week later. Rosenthal asked the commissioner about a different Queens-based homicide, and the commissioner, thinking he was being questioned about the Genovese case, revealed something staggering that had been uncovered by the police investigation. It was something that left everyone who heard it, the commissioner included, aghast and grasping for explanations. Catherine Genovese had not experienced a quick, muffled death. It had been a long, loud, tortured, public event. Her assailant had chased and attacked her in the street three times over a period of 35 minutes before his knife finally silenced her cries for help. Incredibly, 38 of her neighbors watched the events of her death unfold from the safety of their apartment windows without so much as lifting a finger to call the police. Rosenthal, a former Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, knew a story when he heard one. On the day of his lunch with the commissioner, he assigned a reporter to investigate the bystander angle of the Genovese incident. Within a week, the Times published a long page-one article that was to create a swirl of controversy and speculation. The first few paragraphs of that report provide the tone and focus of the burgeoning story. For more than half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew Gardens. Twice the sound of their voices and the sudden glow of their bedroom lights interrupted him and frightened him off. Each time he returned, sought her out, and stabbed her again. Not one person telephoned the police during the assault. One witness called after the woman was dead. That was 2 weeks ago today, but Assistant Chief Inspector Frederick M. Lucen, in charge of the borough's detectives and a veteran of 25 years of homicide investigations, is still shocked. He can give a matter-of-fact recitation of many murders, but the Kew Gardens slaying baffles him, not because it is a murder, but because good people failed to call the police. As with Assistant Chief Inspector Lucen, shock and bafflement were the standard reactions of almost everyone who learned the story's details. The shock struck first, leaving the police, the news people, and the reading public stunned. The bafflement followed quickly. How could 38 good people fail to act under those circumstances? No one could understand it. Even the murder witnesses themselves were bewildered. "I don't know," they answered one after another. "I just don't know." A few offered weak reasons for their inaction. For example, two or three people explained that they were afraid or did not want to get involved. But these reasons do not stand up to close scrutiny. A simple, anonymous call to the police could have saved Catherine Genovese without threatening the witness's future safety or free time. No, it wasn't the observer's fear or reluctance to complicate their lives that explained their lack of action. Something else was going on there that even they could not fathom. Confusion, though, does not make for good news copy. So the press, as well as the other media, several papers, TV stations, and magazines were pursuing follow-up stories by now, emphasized the only explanation available at the time. The witnesses, no different from the rest of us, hadn't cared enough to get involved. We were becoming a nation of selfish, insensitive people. The rigors of modern life, especially city life, were hardening us. We were becoming the cold society, unfeeling and indifferent to the plight of our fellow citizens. In support of this interpretation, news stories began appearing regularly in which various kinds of public apathy were detailed. The Times actually appears to have developed an apathy beat for a period following the Genovese revelations. Also supporting such an interpretation were the remarks of a range of armchair social commentators who, as a breed, seem never to admit to bafflement when speaking to the press. They too saw the Genovese case as having large-scale social significance. All used the word apathy, which, it is interesting to note, had been in the headline of the Times front-page story, although they accounted for the apathy differently. One attributed it to the effects of TV violence, another to repressed aggressiveness. But most implicated the depersonalization of urban life, with its megalopolitan societies and its alienation of the individual from the group. Even Rosenthal, the newsman who first broke the story and who ultimately made it the subject of a book, subscribed to the city-caused apathy theory. Nobody can say why the 38 did not lift the phone while Miss Genovese was being attacked, since they cannot say themselves. It can be assumed, however, that their apathy was indeed one of the big city variety. It is almost a matter of psychological survival if one is surrounded and pressed by millions of people to prevent them from constantly impinging on you, and the only way to do this is to ignore them as often as possible. Indifference to one's neighbor and his troubles is a conditioned reflex in life in New York, as it is in other big cities. As the Genovese story grew, aside from Rosenthal's book, it became the focus of numerous newspaper and magazine pieces, several television news documentaries, and an off-Broadway play. It attracted the professional attention of a pair of New York-based psychology professors, Bibb Latané and John Darley. They examined the reports of the Genovese incident and, on the basis of their knowledge of social psychology, hit on what had seemed the most unlikely explanation of all. It was that 38 witnesses were present. Previous accounts of the story had invariably emphasized that no action was taken, even though 38 individuals had looked on. Latané and Darley suggested that no one had helped precisely because there were so many observers. The psychologists speculated that, for at least two reasons, a bystander to an emergency would be unlikely to help when there were a number of other bystanders present. The first reason is fairly straightforward. With several potential helpers around, the personal responsibility of each individual is reduced. Perhaps someone else will give or call for aid. Perhaps someone else already has. So with everyone thinking that someone else will help or has called, no one does. The second reason is the more psychologically intriguing one. It is founded on the principle of social proof and involves the pluralistic ignorance effect. Very often, an emergency is not obviously an emergency. Is the man lying in the alley a heart attack victim or a drunk sleeping one off? Are the sharp sounds from the street gunshots or truck backfires? Is the commotion next door an assault requiring the police or an especially loud marital spat where intervention would be inappropriate and unwelcome? What is going on? In times of such uncertainty, the natural tendency is to look around at the actions of others for clues. We can learn from the way the other witnesses are reacting whether the event is or is not an emergency. What is easy to forget, though, is that everybody else observing the event is likely to be looking for social evidence, too. And because we all prefer to appear poised and unflustered among others, we are likely to search for that evidence placidly with brief, camouflaged glances at those around us. Therefore, everyone is likely to see everyone else looking unruffled and failing to act. As a result, and by the principles of social proof, the event will be roundly interpreted as a non-emergency. This, according to Latané and Darley, is the state of pluralistic ignorance, in which each person decides that since nobody is concerned, nothing is wrong. Meanwhile, the danger may be mounting to the point where a single individual, uninfluenced by the seeming calm of others, would react. The fascinating upshot of Latané and Darley's reasoning is that, for the emergency victim, the idea of safety in numbers may often be completely wrong. It might be that someone in need of emergency aid would have a better chance of survival if a single bystander rather than a crowd was present. To test this unusual thesis, Darley, Latané, their students, and colleagues performed a systematic and impressive program of research that produced a clear set of findings. Their basic procedure was to stage emergency events that were observed either by a single individual or by a group of people. They then recorded the number of times the emergency victim received help under those circumstances. In their first experiment, a New York college student who appeared to be having an epileptic seizure received help 85% of the time when there was a single bystander present, but only 31% of the time with five bystanders present. With almost all the single bystanders helping, it becomes difficult to argue that ours is the cold society where no one cares for suffering others. Obviously, it was something about the presence of other bystanders that reduced helping to shameful levels. Other studies have examined the importance of social proof in causing widespread witness apathy. They have done so by planting within a group of witnesses to a possible emergency people who are rehearsed to act as if no emergency were occurring. For instance, in another New York-based experiment, 75% of lone individuals who observed smoke seeping from under a door reported the leak. However, when similar leaks were observed by three-person groups, the smoke was reported only 38% of the time. The smallest number of bystanders took action, though, when the three-person groups included two individuals who had been coached to ignore the smoke. Under those conditions, the leaks were reported only 10% of the time. In a similar study conducted in Toronto, single bystanders provided emergency aid 90% of the time, whereas such aid occurred in only 16% of the cases when a bystander was in the presence of two other bystanders who remained passive. After more than a decade of such research, social scientists now have a good idea of when a bystander will offer emergency aid. First, and contrary to the view that we have become a society of callous, uncaring people, once witnesses are convinced that an emergency situation exists, aid is very likely. Under these conditions, the numbers of bystanders who either intervene themselves or summon help is quite comforting. For example, in four separate experiments done in Florida, accident scenes involving a maintenance man were staged. When it was clear that the man was hurt and required assistance, he was helped 100% of the time in two of the experiments. In the other two experiments, where helping involved contact with potentially dangerous electrical wires, the victim still received bystander aid in 90% of the instances. In addition, these extremely high levels of assistance occurred whether the witnesses observed the events singly or in groups. The situation becomes very different when, as in many cases, bystanders cannot be sure that the event they are witnessing is an emergency. Then, a victim is much more likely to be helped by a lone bystander than by a group, especially if the people in the group are strangers to one another. It seems that the pluralistic ignorance effect is strongest among strangers. Because we like to look poised and sophisticated in public, and because we are unfamiliar with the reactions of those we do not know, we are unlikely to give off or correctly read expressions of concern when in a grouping of strangers. Therefore, a possible emergency becomes viewed as a non-emergency, and the victim suffers. A close look at this set of research findings reveals an enlightening pattern. All the conditions that decrease an emergency victim's chances for bystander aid exist normally and innocently in the city. 1. In contrast to rural areas, cities are more clamorous, distracting, rapidly changing places where it is difficult to be certain of the nature of the events one encounters. 2. Urban environments are more populous by their nature. Consequently, people are more likely to be with others when witnessing a potential emergency situation. 3. City dwellers know a much smaller percentage of fellow residents than do people who live in small towns. Therefore, city dwellers are more likely to find themselves in a group of strangers when observing an emergency. These three natural characteristics of urban environments, their confusion, their populousness, and their low levels of acquaintanceship, fit in very well with the factors shown by research to decrease bystander aid. Without ever having to resort to such sinister concepts as urban depersonalization and megalopolitan alienation, then we can explain why so many instances of bystander inaction occurs in our cities. De-victimizing yourself. But explaining the dangers of modern urban life in less ominous terms does not dispel them. And as the world's populations move increasingly to the cities, half of all humanity will be city dwellers within 10 years. There will be a growing need to reduce those dangers. Fortunately, our newfound understanding of the bystander apathy process offers real hope. Armed with this scientific knowledge, an emergency victim can increase enormously the chances of receiving aid from others. The key is the realization that groups of bystanders fail to help because the bystanders are unsure rather than unkind. They don't help because they are unsure of whether an emergency actually exists and whether they are responsible for taking action. When they are sure of their responsibilities for intervening in a clear emergency, people are exceedingly responsive. Once it is understood that the enemy is not some unmanageable societal condition like urban depersonalization, but is instead the simple state of uncertainty, it becomes possible for emergency victims to take specific steps to protect themselves by reducing the bystander's uncertainty. Imagine, for example, you are spending a summer afternoon at a music concert in the park. As the concert ends and people begin leaving, you notice a slight numbness in one arm but dismiss it as nothing to be alarmed about. Yet, while moving with the crowd to the distant parking areas, you feel the numbness spreading down to your hand and up one side of your face. Feeling disoriented, you decide to sit against a tree for a moment to rest. Soon, you realize that something is drastically wrong. Sitting down has not helped. In fact, the control and coordination of your muscles has worsened to the point that you are starting to have difficulty moving your mouth and tongue to speak. You try to get up, but can't. A terrifying thought slashes to mind. Oh, God, I'm having a stroke. Groups of people are passing by, and most are paying you no attention. The few who notice the odd way you are slumped against the tree or the strange look on your face check the social evidence around them, and, seeing that no one else is reacting with concern, walk on, past, convinced that nothing is wrong. Were you to find yourself in such a predicament, what could you do to overcome the odds against receiving help? Because your physical abilities would be deteriorating, time would be crucial. If before you could summon aid, you lost your speech or mobility or consciousness, your chances for assistance and for recovery would plunge drastically. It would be essential to try to request help quickly. But what would the most effective form of that request be? Moans, groans, or outcries probably would not do. They might bring you some attention, but they would not provide enough information to assure passersby that a true emergency existed. If mere outcries are unlikely to produce help from the passing crowd, perhaps you should be more specific. Indeed, you need to do more than try to gain attention. You should call out clearly your need for assistance. You must not allow bystanders to define your situation as a non-emergency. Use the word help to cry out your need for emergency aid. And don't worry about being wrong. Embarrassment is a villain to be crushed here. In the context of a possible stroke, you cannot afford to be worried about the awkwardness of overestimating your problem. The difference in cost is that between a moment of embarrassment and possible death or lifelong paralysis. But even a resounding call for help is not your most effective tactic, although it may reduce bystanders' doubts about whether a real emergency exists. It will not remove several other important uncertainties within each onlooker's mind. What kind of aid is required here? Should I be the one to provide the aid, or should someone more qualified do it? Has someone else already gone to get professional help, or is it my responsibility? While the bystanders stand gawking at you and grappling with these questions, time vital to your survival could be slipping away. Clearly, then, as a victim, you must do more than alert bystanders to your need for emergency assistance. You must also remove their uncertainties about how that assistance should be provided and who should provide it. But what would be the most efficient and reliable way to do so? Based on the research findings we have seen, my advice would be to isolate one individual from the crowd. Stare, speak, and point directly at that person and no one else. "You, sir, in the blue jacket, I need help. Call an ambulance." With that one utterance, you should dispel all the uncertainties that might prevent or delay help. With that one statement, you will have put the man in the blue jacket in the role of rescuer. He should now understand that emergency aid is needed. He should understand that he, not someone else, is responsible for providing the aid. And finally, he should understand exactly how to provide it. All the scientific evidence indicates that the result should be quick, effective assistance. In general, then, your best strategy when in need of emergency help is to reduce the uncertainties of those around you concerning your condition and their responsibilities. Be as precise as possible about your need for aid. Do not allow bystanders to come to their own conclusions because, especially in a crowd, the principle of social proof and the consequent pluralistic ignorance effect might well cause them to view your situation as a non-emergency. And request assistance of a single individual from the group of onlookers. Fight the natural tendency to make a general request for help. Pick out one person and assign the task to that individual. Otherwise, it is too easy for everyone in the crowd to assume that someone else should help, will help, or has helped. Of all the techniques in this book designed to produce compliance with a request, this one may be the most important to remember. After all, the failure of your request for emergency aid could have severe personal consequences. Not long ago, I received some first-hand evidence on this point. I was involved in a rather serious automobile collision. Both I and the other driver were plainly hurt. He was slumped unconscious over his steering wheel, while I managed to stagger, bloody, from behind mine. The accident had occurred in the center of an intersection in full view of several individuals stopped in their cars at the traffic light. As I knelt in the road beside my door trying to clear my head, the light changed, and the waiting cars began to roll slowly through the intersection. Their drivers gawked, but did not stop. I remember thinking, "Oh no, it's happening just like the research says. They're all passing by." I consider it fortunate that, as a social psychologist, I knew enough about the bystander studies to have that particular thought. By thinking of my predicament in terms of the research findings, I knew exactly what to do. Pulling myself up so I could be seen clearly, I pointed at the driver of one car, "Call the police," to a second and a third driver, pointing directly each time, "Pull over, we need help." The responses of these people were instantaneous. They summoned a police car and ambulance immediately. They used their handkerchiefs to blot the blood from my face. They put a jacket under my head. They volunteered to serve as witnesses to the accident. One even offered to ride with me to the hospital. Not only was this help rapid and solicitous, it was infectious. After drivers entering the intersection from the other direction saw cars stopping for me, they stopped and began tending to the other victim. The principle of social proof was working for us now. The trick had been to get the ball rolling in the direction of aid. Once that was accomplished, I was able to relax and let the bystanders' genuine concern and social proof's natural momentum do the rest. Monkey me, monkey do. A bit earlier, we stated that the principle of social proof, like all other weapons of influence, works better under some conditions than under others. We have already explored one of those conditions, uncertainty. Without question, when people are uncertain, they are more likely to use others' actions to decide how they themselves should act. But in addition, there is another important working condition, similarity. The principle of social proof operates most powerfully when we are observing the behavior of people just like us. It is the conduct of such people that gives us the greatest insight into what constitutes correct behavior for ourselves. Therefore, we are more inclined to follow the lead of a similar individual than a dissimilar one. That is why I believe we are seeing an increasing number of average person on the street testimonials on TV these days. Advertisers now know that one successful way to sell a product to ordinary viewers, who compose the largest potential market, is to demonstrate that other ordinary people like and use it. So whether the product is a brand of soft drink or pain reliever or laundry detergent, we hear volleys of praise from John or Mary every person. More compelling evidence for the importance of similarity in determining whether we will imitate another's behavior comes from scientific research. An especially apt illustration can be found in a study done several years ago by Columbia University psychologists. The researchers placed wallets on the ground in various locations around Midtown Manhattan to observe what would happen when they were found. The wallets all contained $2 in cash, a $26.30 check, and various information providing the name and address of the wallet's owner. In addition to this material, the wallet also contained a letter that made it evident that the wallet had been lost not once, but twice. The letter was written to the wallet's owner from a man who had found it earlier and whose intention was to return it. The finder indicated in his letter that he was happy to help and that the chance to be of service in this way had made him feel good. It was evident to anyone who found one of these wallets that this well-intentioned individual had then lost the wallet himself on the way to the mailbox. The wallet was wrapped in an envelope addressed to the owner. The researchers wanted to know how many people finding such a wallet would follow the lead of the first finder and mail it, intact, to the original owner. Before they dropped the wallets, however, the researchers varied one feature of the letter it contained. Some of the letters were written in standard English by what seemed to be an average American, while the other letters were written in broken English by the first finder, who identified himself as a recently arrived foreigner. In other words, the person who had initially found the wallet and had tried to return it was depicted by the letter as being either similar or dissimilar to most Americans. The interesting question was whether the Manhattanites who found the wallet and letter would be more influenced to mail the wallet if the first man who had tried to do so was similar to them. The answer was plain. Only 33% of the wallets were returned when the first finder was seen as dissimilar, but fully 70% were returned when he was thought to be a similar other. These results suggest an important qualification of the principle of social proof. We will use the actions of others to decide on proper behavior for ourselves, especially when we view those others as similar to ourselves. This tendency applies not only to adults, but to children as well. Health researchers have found, for example, that a school-based anti-smoking program had lasting effects only when it used same-age peer leaders as teachers. Another study found that children who saw a film depicting a child's positive visit to the dentist lowered their own dental anxieties principally when they were the same age as the child in the film. I wish I had known about this second study when, a few years before it was published, I was trying to reduce a different kind of anxiety in my son, Chris. I live in Arizona, where backyard swimming pools abound. One regrettable consequence is that every year several young children drown after falling into an unattended pool. I was determined, therefore, to teach Chris how to swim at an early age. The problem was not that he was afraid of the water. He loved it. But he would not get into the pool without wearing his inflatable plastic inner tube, no matter how I tried to coax, talk, or shame him out of it. After getting nowhere for 2 months, I hired some help, a graduate student of mine, a big, strapping former lifeguard who had once worked as a swimming instructor. He failed as totally as I had. He couldn't persuade Chris to attempt even a stroke outside of his plastic ring. Around this time, Chris was attending a day camp that provided a number of activities to its members, including use of a large pool, which he scrupulously avoided. One day, shortly after the graduate student fiasco, I went to get Chris from camp a bit early and, with mouth agape, watched him run down the diving board and jump into the middle of the deepest part of the pool. Panicking, I began pulling off my shoes to jump in to his rescue when I saw him bob to the surface and paddle safely to the side of the pool, where I dashed, shoes in hand, to meet him. "Chris, you can swim," I said excitedly. "You can swim." Yes, he responded casually. I learned how today. This is terrific. This is just terrific, I burbled, gesturing expansively to convey my enthusiasm. But how come you didn't need your plastic ring today? Looking somewhat embarrassed because his father seemed to be raving while inexplicably soaking his socks in a small puddle and waving his shoes around, Chris explained, Well, I'm 3 years old, and Tommy is 3 years old, and Tommy can swim without a ring, so that means I can too. I could have kicked myself. Of course, it would be to little Tommy, not to a 6-foot-2-inch graduate student, that Chris would look for the most relevant information about what he could or should do. Had I been more thoughtful about solving Chris's swimming problem, I could have employed Tommy's good example earlier and perhaps have saved myself a couple of frustrating months. I could have simply noted at the day camp that Tommy was a swimmer and then arranged with his parents for the boys to spend a weekend afternoon swimming in our pool. My guess is that Chris's plastic ring would have been abandoned by the end of the day. Any factor that can spur 70% of New Yorkers to return a wallet, or can reduce the likelihood that kids will take up smoking or will fear a dentist visit, must be considered impressive. Yet research findings of this sort offer just a hint of the immense impact that the conduct of similar others has on human behavior. Other more powerful examples exist. To my mind, the most telling illustration of this impact starts with a seemingly nonsensical statistic. After a suicide has made front-page news, airplanes, private planes, corporate jets, airliners, begin falling out of the sky at an alarming rate. For example, it has been shown that immediately following certain kinds of highly publicized suicide stories, the number of people who die in commercial airline crashes increases by 1,000%. Even more alarming, the increase is not limited to airplane deaths. The number of automobile fatalities shoots up as well. What could possibly be responsible? One explanation suggests itself immediately. The same social conditions that cause some people to commit suicide cause others to die accidentally. For instance, certain individuals, the suicide prone, may react to stressful societal events, economic downturns, rising crime rates, international tensions, by ending it all. But others will react differently to these same events. They might become angry or impatient or nervous or distracted. To the degree that such people operate or service the cars and planes of our society, the vehicles will be less safe, and consequently we will see a sharp increase in the number of automobile and air fatalities. According to this social conditions interpretation, then, some of the same societal factors that cause intentional deaths also cause accidental ones, and that is why we find so strong a connection between suicide stories and fatal crashes. But another fascinating statistic indicates that this is not the correct explanation. Fatal crashes increase dramatically only in those regions where the suicide has been highly publicized. Other places, existing under similar social conditions, whose newspapers have not publicized the story, have shown no comparable jump in such fatalities. Furthermore, within those areas where newspaper space has been allotted, the wider the publicity given the suicide, the greater has been the rise in subsequent crashes. Thus, it is not some set of common societal events that stimulates suicides on the one hand and fatal accidents on the other. Instead, it is the publicized suicide story itself that produces the car and plane wrecks. To explain the strong association between suicide story publicity and subsequent crashes, a bereavement account has been suggested. Because it has been argued front-page suicides often involve well-known and respected public figures, perhaps their highly publicized deaths throw many people into states of shocked sadness. Stunned and preoccupied, these individuals become careless around cars and planes. The consequence is the sharp increase in deadly accidents involving such vehicles that we see after front-page suicide stories. Although the bereavement theory can account for the connection between the degree of publicity given a story and subsequent crash fatalities, the more people who learn of the suicide, the larger number of bereaved and careless individuals there will be. It cannot explain yet another startling fact. Newspaper stories reporting on suicide victims who died alone produce an increase in the frequency of single fatality wrecks only, whereas stories reporting on suicide plus murder incidents produce an increase in multiple fatality wrecks only. Simple bereavement could not cause such a pattern. The influence of suicide stories on car and plane crashes, then, is fantastically specific. Stories of pure suicides, in which only one person dies, generate wrecks in which only one person dies. Stories of suicide-murder combinations, in which there are multiple deaths, generate wrecks in which there are multiple deaths. If neither social conditions nor bereavement account for this bewildering array of facts, what can? There is a sociologist at the University of California at San Diego who thinks he has found the answer. His name is David Phillips, and he points a convincing finger at something called the Werther effect. The story of the Werther effect is both chilling and intriguing. More than two centuries ago, the great man of German literature, Johann von Goethe, published a novel entitled Die Leiden des jungen Werthers, The Sorrows of Young Werther. The book in which the hero, named Werther, commits suicide had a remarkable impact. Not only did it provide Goethe with immediate fame, but it also sparked a wave of emulative suicides across Europe. So powerful was this effect that authorities in several countries banned the novel. Professor Phillips' own work has traced the Werther effect to modern times. His research has demonstrated that immediately following a front-page suicide story, the suicide rate increases dramatically in those geographical areas where the story has been highly publicized. It is Phillips' argument that certain troubled people who read of another's self-inflicted death kill themselves in imitation. In a morbid illustration of the principle of social proof, these people decide how they should act on the basis of how some other troubled person has acted. Phillips got his evidence for the modern-day Werther effect by examining the suicide statistics in the United States between 1947 and 1968. He found that within 2 months after every front-page suicide story, an average of 58 more people than usual killed themselves. In a sense, each suicide story killed 58 people who otherwise would have gone on living. Phillips also found that this tendency for suicides to beget suicides occurred principally in those parts of the country where the first suicide was highly publicized, and that the wider the publicity given the first suicide, the greater the number of later suicides. If the facts surrounding the Werther effect seem to you suspiciously like those surrounding the influence of suicide stories on air and traffic fatalities, the similarities have not been lost on Professor Phillips either. In fact, he contends that all the excess deaths following a front-page suicide incident can be explained as the same thing. Copycat suicides. Upon learning of another suicide, an uncomfortably large number of people decide that suicide is an appropriate action for themselves as well. Some of these individuals then proceed to commit the act in a straightforward, no-bones-about-it fashion, causing the suicide rate to jump. Others, however, are less direct. For any of several reasons, to protect their reputations, to spare their families the shame and hurt, to allow their dependents to collect on insurance policies, they do not want to appear to have killed themselves. They would rather seem to have died accidentally. So, purposefully but furtively, they cause the wreck of a car or a plane they are operating or are simply riding in. This could be accomplished in a variety of all too familiar sounding ways. A commercial airline pilot could dip the nose of the aircraft at a crucial point of takeoff, or could inexplicably land on an already occupied runway against instructions from the control tower. The driver of a car could suddenly swerve into a tree or into oncoming traffic. A passenger in an automobile or corporate jet could incapacitate the operator, causing a deadly crash. The pilot of a private plane could, despite all radio warnings, plow into another aircraft. Thus, the alarming climb in crash fatalities we find following front-page suicides is, according to Dr. Phillips, most likely due to the Werther effect secretly applied. I consider this insight brilliant. First, it explains all the data beautifully. If these wrecks really are hidden instances of imitative suicide, it makes sense that we should see an increase in the wrecks after suicide stories appear, and it makes sense that the greatest rise in wrecks should occur after the suicide stories that have been most widely publicized and have consequently reached the most people. And it makes sense that the number of crashes should jump appreciably only in those geographical areas where the suicide stories were publicized. And it even makes sense that single-victim suicides should lead only to single-victim crashes, whereas multiple-victim suicide incidents should lead only to multiple-victim crashes. Imitation is the key. But there is a second valuable feature of Phillips' insight. Not only does it allow us to explain the existing facts, it also allows us to predict new facts that had never been uncovered before. For example, if the abnormally frequent crashes following publicized suicides are genuinely due to imitative rather than accidental actions, they should be more deadly as a result. That is, people trying to kill themselves will likely arrange with a foot on the accelerator instead of the brake, with the nose of the plane down instead of up, for the impact to be as lethal as possible. The consequence should be quick and sure death. When Phillips examined the records to check on this prediction, he found that the average number of people killed in a fatal crash of a commercial airliner is more than 3 times greater if the crash happened 1 week after a front-page suicide story than if it happened 1 week before. A similar phenomenon can be found in traffic statistics, where there is evidence for the deadly efficiency of post-suicide story auto crashes. Victims of fatal car wrecks that follow front-page suicide stories die 4 times more quickly than normal. Programs was followed by an average increase of 35 suicides over what would have been expected in the next week. What's more, televised movies and public service programs on the topic, even those designed to reduce the problem, create an immediate cluster of self-inflicted deaths, with impressionable, imitation-prone teenagers being the most frequent victims. Still another fascinating prediction flows from Phillips' idea. If the increase in wrecks following suicide stories truly represents a set of copycat deaths, then the imitators should be most likely to copy the suicides of people who are similar to them. The principle of social proof states that we use information about how others have behaved to help us determine proper conduct for ourselves. But as the dropped wallet experiment showed, we are most influenced in this fashion by the actions of others like us. Therefore, Phillips reasoned, if the principle of social proof is behind the phenomenon, there should be some clear similarity between the victim of the highly publicized suicide and those who cause subsequent wrecks. Realizing that the clearest test of this possibility would come from the records of automobile crashes involving a single car and a lone driver, Phillips compared the age of the suicide story victim with the ages of the lone drivers killed in single car crashes immediately after the story appeared in print. Once again, the predictions were strikingly accurate. When the newspaper detailed the suicide of a young person, it was young drivers who then piled their cars into trees, poles, and embankments with fatal results. But when the news story concerned an older person's suicide, older drivers died in such crashes. I advise, then, to take special care on our travels at these times. This last statistic is the crusher for me. I am left wholly convinced and simultaneously wholly amazed by it. Evidently, the principle of social proof is so wide-ranging and powerful that its domain extends to the fundamental decision for life or death. Professor Phillips' findings have persuaded me of a distressing tendency for suicide publicity to motivate certain people who are similar to the victim to kill themselves, because they now find the idea of suicide more legitimate. Truly frightening are the data indicating that many innocent people die in the bargain. A glance at the graphs documenting the undeniable increase in traffic and air fatalities following publicized suicides, especially those involving murder, is enough to cause concern for one's own safety. I have been sufficiently affected by these statistics to begin to take note of front-page suicide stories and to change my behavior in the period after their appearance. I try to be especially cautious behind the wheel of my car. I am reluctant to take extended trips requiring a lot of air travel. If I must fly during such a period, I purchase substantially more flight insurance than I normally would. Dr. Phillips has done us a service by demonstrating that the odds for survival when we travel change measurably for a time following the publication of certain kinds of front-page suicide stories. It would seem only prudent to play those odds. As if the frightening features of Phillips' suicide data weren't enough, his subsequent research brings more cause for alarm. Homicides in this country have a stimulated copycat character after highly publicized acts of violence. Heavyweight champion prize fights that receive coverage on network evening news appear to produce measurable increases in the U.S. homicide rate. This analysis of heavyweight championship fights between 1973 and 1978 is perhaps most compelling in its demonstration of the remarkably specific nature of the imitative aggression that is generated. When such a match was lost by a black fighter, the homicide rate during the following 10 days rose significantly for young black male victims, but not young white males. On the other hand, when a white fighter lost a match, it was young white men, but not young black men, who were killed more frequently in the next 10 days. When these results are combined with the parallel findings in Phillips' suicide data, it is clear that widely publicized aggression has the nasty tendency to spread to similar victims, no matter whether the aggression is inflicted on the self or on another. Work like Dr. Phillips's helps us appreciate the awesome influence of the behavior of similar others. Once the enormity of that force is recognized, it becomes possible to understand perhaps the most spectacular act of compliance of our time, the mass suicide at Jonestown, Guyana. Certain crucial features of that event deserve review. The People's Temple was a cult-like organization that began in San Francisco and drew its recruits from the poor of that city. In 1977, the Reverend Jim Jones